Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Engineering Entrepreneur Podcast, episode 153. As always, this is your host, Scott Tarsi, and I run CADDesignHelp.com. Head on over to the website there, again, CADDesignHelp.com, and you can sign up my email list, and it will send you a free PDF, and you'll get updates on everything. Check out my online course, How to Become an Engineering Entrepreneur. Leave me a review on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use, and for any feedback, send me an email, info@caddesignhelp.com. Our guest this week is Wael El Sahar. I think I said that right. And he's the Chief Technology and Product Officer at Imprint, not imprint.com. This is different. Imprint.co. It's a fast-growing fintech company that partners with leading brands to launch co-branded credit cards. So, well, thanks for coming on the show. Let's hear about your background first, and then we can talk more about the company.
Yeah, Scott, thanks for having me. Been really looking forward to this conversation. My name is Wael. I grew up in Egypt, like if you want to start at the beginning. I am a little bit older. When I was 11, I got into computers. I was very excited about that. I think my first computer is a computer that I assembled myself with a bunch of different components I collected over like a few months because that's all I could afford. And that's when I fell in love with computers, software, engineering. And I kind of grew up, ended up going to doing computer science in Egypt, ended up working at IBM at the time when IBM was still kind of a very technologically advanced company. Learned a lot about software engineering there, and then decided that I want to learn about this thing called business. Engineers seem to be working for business people, so I wanted to figure out what those business people do. At the time, my best idea about that was going to business school. So I decided that I'll go to the US. Apparently, they have the best business schools there. And went to business school in New York, ended up working in consulting for a couple of years. But then it was very clear to me that I just liked building stuff with my hands, like coding. And I wanted to go back to work to technology. So after a few years in a consulting firm, I went over to Amazon. That was around 2014. Amazon at the time was not a small company by any stretch of imagination. They had around 40,000 people. But for comparison, by the time I left in 2021, Amazon had 2.5 million people.
Oh, wow. Yeah, how many do they have now? I guess probably 3 million, 4 million.
Something along those lines. Most of that number is in fulfillment center associates, but still huge growth. So in retrospect, I feel like I joined Amazon when it was a tiny kind of startup. And it was a lot of fun. Amazon was, as a lot of people know, has so many different businesses. You can explore so many different problems. And I was lucky enough to end up having to do end up w doing work in the financial services fintech space. So initially, Amazon was building this B2B marketplace, became named Amazon Business later on. And as part of that, they figured out that we need to accept different kinds of payments. We need to be able to accept invoice payments. We need to have a small business credit card. So I was part of the team that was building that. And then after a few years, I moved over to the consumer side, where I was in charge of the product team for Amazon Pay globally. And Amazon Pay was the wallet service for Amazon. So something like PayPal. It was actually the second biggest after PayPal before a lot of new competitors came to the market. And it was a lot of fun. Payments and financial services are very human things. People care about their money and they get worked up about when things don't work out well, and they get very excited when they do. So being able to do that across so many different continents and countries was great. But yeah, by the time, as I mentioned earlier, Amazon became like a 2 million people company, things started slowing down. You don't get to build as much, especially as you get more senior. You get to argue about what we should build for years. So I knew I needed to go work for a smaller startup, someone who's building stuff from scratch. And that's how I ended up at Imprint.
Okay. So how did you meet the founder of Imprint?
We had common people. We actually, both of us worked in the same consulting firm. Kind of, we didn't know each other, but we had common people. And as he was building the company, he was trying to figure out who in his extended network understands product in that space. So we got introduced that way, and that's when he started telling me about his idea about building this co-branded credit card issuing business. And my first reaction was, this is a great idea. I'm going to invest in the company. I don't know if I'm going to work there yet, but this will work. And the reason I thought this would work is that when I was at Amazon, I was close enough to the teams working on Amazon's co-branded credit card relationships with Chase, with Amex, with Synchrony. And you can see that even though for these banks, Amazon is probably one of their biggest partners on the co-branded side. The experience left a lot to be desired, right? Like, it was not very technologically advanced. The customer experience was not great. So I knew that if someone comes in,
Let's dig into that because I don't know. Well, let's slow down. Like, talk about what a co-branded credit card is. I don't think a lot of people know what that means. And then talk about how the one at Amazon wasn't good. Like, let's hear some examples and like how Imprint is improving upon that, because that seems like what your value add is.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that. I kind of assume everyone, of course, knows what co-branded cards is, but that's just my world. So there are two big kinds of credit cards in the market, at least in the US. There is bank-branded credit cards and then co-branded credit cards. Bank-branded credit cards are cards like Chase Sapphire, Capital One Cash. Those are cards that are issued by the banks, has their own logo on it, and it's one of the financial products that they offer to their customers. It's a lending product, has some rewards on top of it, and customers like them because, again, you're getting some credit to spend, you're getting some cash back or some sort of form of points on top of it. The other big category of credit cards are the co-branded credit cards, and those are the cards that are issued by a bank in partnership with a big consumer brand. Typically, the most popular ones are airline credit cards. So Delta Amex credit card, for example. There are a lot of the hotel chains credit cards. So the
Or
Marriott.
like Walmart's a co-branded credit card, right?
Exactly,
They
exactly.
partner with MasterCard. Okay. And what is the advantage of, like, why is this better? I mean, who is it better for, I guess, but why does it exist?
So co-branded cards exist because they do two things. One, they're as good as normal credit cards. You can borrow money on it. You can spend it anywhere. If it's a network card, which means it has a Visa or a MasterCard or Amex logo on it, you can use it anywhere. You can use it online anywhere. So it is as good as a credit card. The advantage of co-branded credit cards is that if you have a relationship with a specific brand, for example, H-E-B down in Texas is one of the grocery chains we work with. You go shop there every week. The co-branded credit cards typically give you additional benefits at that brand. So for us, in our case, when you go shop at H-E-B, you get 5% back, and in addition to any other discounts that are available. So for customers who buy a lot of groceries, or travel a lot on airlines or hotels, they want to have the card for the brand that they usually
Okay,
transact with, so they
I
get the
completely get
rewards.
that. I completely get that. That makes a lot of sense now. Because yes, like the credit card, like I now that I think about it, I don't use the credit card really ever that I got from my bank, because the rewards are just not as good
Exactly.
as the other ones. Because the rewards that me specifically like is I like the travel, so I have the airline one. And then the one that I really use the most is on Amazon. I hate going shopping. So I buy on Amazon constantly. I just buy basic things I need, like, groceries and whatever, stuff around the house. And, anything I buy on Amazon gets 5% cash back, which is honestly really good. And so it's like, Yeah, that's okay. So that is now I'm not connecting the dots. So go ahead. I'll just interject there real quick.
No worries. That's exactly it. And actually, on your point about airlines, I had a Delta Amex card at some point, and exclusively for a few years, I would refuse to fly out on any other airline other than Delta because I want to get the points. I want to get to the status. I live in LA, and I live very close to the Burbank Airport, but I would drive to the other side of the city to go to LAX to fly Delta because that's where I get my points. So it's a huge driver of customer behavior. So for brands, it makes a lot of sense to have a credit card because you'll have a lot of people like me who are going to just consolidate all their spend in that category, at least in that brand. The challenge is that the airline or Amazon or HEB cannot actually issue a credit card. Like, there's a lot of banking operations there. You need to lend money, you need to underwrite, you need to collect, you need to deal with chargebacks and fraud and all that stuff. So they have to issue credit cards in partnership with banks. So your Amazon card is probably issued by Chase, unless you have the store card that is issued by Synchrony. And in these relationships, Chase or Synchrony are the issuer in the co-branded relationship. So to your question about what was not working at Amazon and why would Imprint do something better, I wouldn't say it was not working at Amazon. I would say what was happening is that in order for Amazon to make the experience of the card good enough for their customers, they had to invest a lot of resources. There are like hundreds of engineers and product people who are building integrations into the wallet. And if you had the card for a while, you remember that you used to have to go to a different website to pay or to see your balance. And after a few years, they were able to bring that over to the Amazon experience. And every time there's a new kind of reward, like for example, we wanted to offer rewards on your Prime card for purchases on Amazon Pay, for example, you had to go through a very long process, like years with the bank to say, how can we do that? How can we personalize it? How can we negotiate it? So what was very clear to me, at least from a business perspective, was that if this is the case with Amazon, which is a very big company, and you can only do things in years with your bank partner who's motivated to serve you well, what happens to all the other brands that are not Amazon, but just slightly smaller? I'm not talking about small brands, like HEB is like tens of billions of dollars, or like Holiday Inn or Westgate. Those people don't have good options in terms of bank partnerships. They don't have someone who's building products that has great customer experience that they would be proud to put in front of their customers. And that was the opportunity for Imprint to come in and build that very customer experience focused, very tech focused credit card issuer.
So are you guys basically the same as like Visa then, where like Visa partners with Walmart, like you guys or another Visa or Discover card that you're partnering with, or do I have that wrong?
Yeah, so we work with Visa, MasterCard, and to for you and for your audience to explain very quickly how credit cards work, there is typically three main parties, right? One is the merchant that you use the credit card in. They have an acquirer that is working with them, but let's just say those are the merchant. There is the network that sits in the middle. That's Visa or MasterCard, or in some cases Amex. And then there is the bank at the back that is actually issuing the card, that is lending the money, that's collecting from customers, that is issuing statements for those customers. So your Amazon card is a Visa Chase card. So it's a card that's issued by Chase Bank and is processed over the Visa network. So in this particular case, we are similar to Chase in that we issue cards that can be processed on the Visa network or the MasterCard network or the Amex network. So we replace the bank. We don't replace the network. The network is still there because they have
So
basically.
you guys are essentially a bank, or do I have
We
that wrong?
are, we, no, no, no. You didn't get it wrong. We work because of how banking regulation works in the US. We work with a sponsor bank that helps us with licensing and regulation and so on. But for all practical purposes, we are the issuing bank for our credit cards.
So, what makes you guys different then?
Yeah, so a couple of things that we kind of thought about from the beginning. One is at the time when we started, the Apple Card has just launched, and everyone was kind of in love with how great the experience is. It's very technologically advanced. It's very cool. And that was only available to Apple. Apple is a huge company. It's the biggest company in the world, and they built that beautiful card. And one of the things we said we are going to set out to do is we're going to build an experience that is as good, if not better, than the Apple Card for all our partner brands. So it doesn't matter if you're a grocery chain down in Texas or like a gas station chain in the Mid-Atlantic, you're going to have the same quality of product that Apple
So
provides
what
us.
are you talking about, the physical card itself?
So we're talking about everything. So we're talking about the physical cards themselves. We're talking about the apps that that you use to manage the credit cards on your iOS and your Android or on web. And we're talking also about the customer service that you'll get if you call us with a problem that you have.
So what made the Apple card so great?
The Apple Card was so great because they built it. First of all, it's very integrated into the Apple phone. So basically, I don't know if you're a user of Apple Pay, but it just you click on a button and the card comes up. And it was the first card that they actually allowed on Apple Wallet until they opened it for other cards. So it was very integrated to your card, to your phone, which you have with you everywhere. They have a lot of great insights and data about your spending. So they have this very nice kind of pie charts that shows here's your credit limit, here's how much you spend. If you spend too much, that line turns red versus green. They had very proactive notifications about your spending trends, and they'll tell you things like, oh, it looks like you're spending more this year than this month than the last month. And they also had a very cool customer support experience where you can go in and text the bank, and they will answer you even if it's like they answer you, you respond
Oh,
back
so
to them.
you could actually text. You didn't have to go pick up and call and wait on hold and all that. Okay, I get what you're saying.
Exactly. So
Yeah.
it felt like the right experience for
But
people
I
who are
hate
used
that.
to
I
being on
hate
their
that.
phone.
I hate that part.
You hate what, the texting?
No, I hate actually having to call. And it's not so much because of course, having to call like it takes up all your attention, but it's more of like I have to read off my card number and then it takes me too long to do it and then it hangs up on me
Exactly.
and then I had to give
Exactly.
my name and my mother's maiden name, and they don't understand what I'm
Yeah.
saying. And it's like, if we just did all through this through written communication, as long as I don't make a typo, which I'm not, because I'm just going to copy and paste from
Yep.
Notepad, like this is going to go so much smoother. And, if I'm in the middle of something, I can take my time doing it. Like, the hope of the guy doesn't disappear. So I like that a lot.
Absolutely. And a lot of our customers kind of like that. And if you think about the number of people who are just used to texting, used to doing everything over messaging, that's the future. That's where everyone is going. But back to your question about what can we do better. So one is having that level of customer experience. And everything I mentioned to you about the Apple Card is now available for all our Imprint programs. But the second piece is also being able to do very unique custom things for the brand. So to give you an example, most credit cards, traditional credit cards, will give you some set percentage for buying at a certain kind of store. So they will say 3% in gas, 2% in restaurants. Because we built a lot of our technology ourselves, and we built it on a very modern kind of standard and stack, we are able to do things like in the case of H-E-B, which I used a couple of times. It's a big grocery store down in Texas. For people who are from Texas are very familiar with it. And it was one of our biggest first partners. We are able to say when you go to the H-E-B store and you buy something, we're going to be able to know what did you buy. And if you buy an HEB branded item, not like a nationally branded item, we will give you higher rewards on that purchase. So that requires us to be integrated into their point of sale to be able to know what's
Okay.
kind of what's in the basket, and give you those rewards. There, another one that we're really excited about is we're working with one of the biggest online travel agencies, OTAs, to issue their card. And we're building this very cool thing where when you use the card to buy a trip on that website, you get a big discount. But also while you are on the trip, so you go to that website, you book the trip to Paris, you go to Paris. While you're in Paris, if you go to a restaurant, we're going to be able to give you 3% off because you're on a trip that is booked through that kind of travel agency. So we're able to do these things again because we built this technology from scratch. We built it with a lot of modern technology versus banks that are literally built 30, 40, 50 years ago. They're still running on mainframes. They're still writing their programs in COBOL. And they can do this stuff, but it will take them like armies of people to do it versus us, where we can do it like can do features like that every other week.
What I mean, getting into the technical side, like what software are you guys using, or what type of code are you using that is so much like more lean compared to them?
Yeah, I mean the software we can talk through it. One of the first assumptions is that we're built in the cloud, which again, for any business starting today, that's almost a given. But most banks are not started today. They have physical data centers with racks that burn, and they have to replace them. So we're fully in the cloud. We can scale up and down as much as we want. AWS is not going to run out of
But
capacity
like
for
even
our.
something built in the cloud has a server somewhere located. Like, are you built on Amazon, AWS,
Yeah,
or
on AWS. So
okay.
we're AWS. We also have this thing, without getting too technical, where we have multi-availability zones. So the servers physically in AWS sit in different locations, some in the east, some on the west.
For
We
sure.
have
That redundancy, you need to have that. Yeah, 100%.
exactly.
Like,
Exactly.
I
You
don't
need to have.
like, I'm sure, like, I use Dropbox to back up my stuff. I'm sure they have, like, servers all around the world and hidden locations, because if they lost my data, like, I would never go, like, they would be done. Like, if they lost someone, not just one person, but if they lost a significant amount of people's, like, data, like, everyone, they would never get this again, because that's the whole point of us using them, is
Yeah,
like, hey,
absolutely.
this stuff is 100% safe. Like, it's not, as long as I can log in, I can get my access.
Yeah, no, totally. And if you think about it from a financial service perspective, it's even scarier, right? Like if someone loses your deposit account data, or like someone is able to get into your credit card and spend a bunch in other places, that's a real risk. And that's why at some level, like you hear me talk about how the banks are slow and they're not innovating, but at some level I understand why they do that, because they want to be very deliberate. They don't want to make a mistake. Mistakes are very costly in that space. So the challenge for us is how to provide that level of security that the bank provides you, what without being static and sitting there not innovating. And that's the needle that we're trying to always kind of, for some reason I forgot that expression, but like the thread, sorry, that's the needle we're trying to thread all the time. So going back on our technology, we're natively in the cloud. We built our ledger system ourselves, and this is for someone who is outside from this space. That's not very clear. Why is that a big deal? To give you an idea about what traditional banks use. Traditional banks use a kind of company called an issuer processor. There are companies like called Fiserv, FIS, Thesis, who are basically spin-outs of these banks in the 80s and 90s. They basically outsourced all their technology. They spun out their technology teams, created those companies, and now they use them to process transactions for us, for them. So, for example, if you use a Citi card, some of Citi cards, that transaction is not going to be processed by Citi. It's going to be processed by a company called Fiserv. Fiserv is an external company that, as I said, has like very old technology. It's very slow to move. They will do the basics, but if you need to do something, as I mentioned, like SKU level rewards, they're not going to be able to do that. So we built that technology. We don't have dependencies on companies like Fiserv or Thesis. We built all that technology ourselves. We use new modern standards. We use Go language for most of our backend. It's a language that was invented by Google around 2015, 2016 for applications that are much bigger than most financial service applications. Imagine like the search kind of on Google, like how many millions of search you get in a second. That's the same technology we're using. So we made a lot of choices that are common in very modern companies like Google or Meta or Amazon, but we're very uncommon for banks. And that's how we're trying to differentiate ourselves by our ability to move very quickly and iterate on that technology.
Gotcha. So you guys probably employ a lot of engineers, I'm assuming, because you guys are building all your technology yourself.
We're building the technology ourselves. So those all our technology, most of it is built by our own engineers. We surprisingly don't have a big engineering team. Again, big and small is very relative. But relative to our revenue and our business size, we have a 40 kind of people engineering team. So not hundreds or thousands like I used to have at Amazon.
I'm a mechanical engineer. I'm curious what types of engineers that you have on the team.
So mostly they're software engineers, but there are different disciplines within software engineers. So we have infrastructure engineers who are making sure that the servers are running to the discussion we just had about AWS and backups and disaster recovery and all that stuff. We have security engineers who make sure that our systems are safe. No one can hack into them. No one can obtain data that they're not authorized for. And then we have what we call front-end engineers. Those are engineers who are designing the applications that you are using, like the Android or the iOS applications or the web applications. And then we have a lot of back-end engineers who are basically designing the money movement and the controls that we have around that. Right. So when a transaction happens here, how do we decide whether or not this is a valid transaction, whether we signal something for fraud? They are the ones who are building the models that identify that last time Scott used that card, he was in Charlottesville, but a day later, I'm seeing that transaction coming out of Honolulu. What happened? Scott might have traveled, but also might be that someone kind of has access
Somebody hacked
to
it, yeah. Somebody hacked it
hack.
somehow, yeah.
Exactly. So we're building models to identify kind of that suspicious behavior, for example.
Right, especially if something right now in Charlotte, and in 2 minutes I bought something in Honolulu. That doesn't make any sense unless I gave someone my credit card number and gave them authorization. You would absolutely want to initiate a call or something, a text to the customer, be like, "Hey, what's going on here? Because this doesn't make any sense." You couldn't be in two places essentially at one time.
So
And
we have.
you see that with other companies already. Like you see that they, like I've had that happen with my Chase card, like weird stuff like that.
No, absolutely. And that's why it's actually a very interesting, like to go on aside on the on fraud. It's a very interesting problem because especially with the internet now, it is normal for me to be sitting here in LA, but I'm making a transaction in, I don't know, in Italy, right? Because it could be online transaction. People travel a lot and so on. So it's not just a matter of setting up rules, like you cannot transact outside of where you live, but you need to be able to predict based on behaviors, based on your tendency to buy online versus to buying offline. How often are you traveling and so on? No one is sitting there tracking all of that stuff, but the models are trying to make correlations and say, well, based on the pattern for this particular customer, this transaction seems suspicious. So
And
let's better.
do you use AI for this? Because I feel like this is something AI is like perfect
Yeah,
for.
absolutely. And that's the joke about how it used to be that you call it AI when it doesn't work, and then when it works, it's called machine learning. So this
Oh,
particular
right.
case,
Because I was wondering what the difference between AI and machine learning is. It's almost the same thing, really.
it is the same thing. I think the last generation of generative AI is a little bit different because you're finally having an output that is human readable. Most machine learning models are just inputting a bunch of numbers that don't make any sense until you actually have the software to kind of decode it. But yeah, it is the underlying technology is the same. We use a lot of machine learning for fraud detection, but we're actually using generative AI as well for some of our internal operations. So when a customer calls us to say, if you called in and said, I have an issue with my Turkish Airlines card, and here's kind of what's happening. As you are talking, we have an agent running that will collect information about your transactions, about kind of activity that happened recently, about some of the fraud kind of trends that we are seeing, and summarize all of that to our agent. So the agent will be able to ask you a question like, did you use your card in this particular chain that we know that had a security kind of incident recently? Or kind of, hey, oh, I've noticed that you have this particular kind of transactions. Are those your transactions? So instead of the agent putting you on hold and try to figure out what happened in your account, that summarization and collection of data is already happening with the AI agent that's running in front of our human agent.
Yeah, that's really smart. I was going to make a comment that I feel like I went into the wrong type of engineering because nobody needs mechanical engineers anymore. They need software engineers for all this stuff. It's like you don't hear about startups like designing a new thing, like physical thing. It's all these more like software types of companies.
But you know what is really interesting as you say that, because we just had a huge discussion in our team about that particular topic, where software engineering can easily get very very abstract, right? Like we're building things that are not real in the physical world, right? It's all
Right.
abstractions and all software and so on. And it's very easy to get very confused about what you're trying to do. And I always find it illuminating to try to think about what is the real engineering parallel to what we are trying to do. So to give you an example, to make it a little bit more real, every software engineering team, ours included, has a very long roadmap of stuff that we need to do. We have like 100 different idea about how can we make the customer experience better, fix some of our operations. But our more junior engineers can get very overwhelmed. They look at it and say, well, this thing will take a month to build, and this other thing will take another month to build. And if I add it all, I need to be working here for 10 years to be able to go through my roadmap. And then you set them down and say, okay, let's think about it. If you are, I don't know, like a civil engineer building a theme park. My father-in-law happens to have done that. So I have that experience in mind. Every theme park project is similar. Like the developer is going to come to you and say, I want all those crazy things. And you have 10% of the budget that you think that you need. You can complain about that, or you can sit down and say, okay, great. What can we trade off? What is the order of priority? What's the order of operations? What are the things that are critical and you cannot compromise on? And what are the things that you can compromise on? And that's how we operate as an engineer in any other discipline, right? Like you make best decisions, you fetch solutions to problems under constraints. That's what you do. So even though we're working in software, I find that every few weeks we have to go back and say, what is the real life equivalent of what we're doing? And how would we solve it if we are trying to build a house rather than build a piece of software? And most of the time, people have been building houses for much longer than doing software. We have a much better intuition for what to do when we think about it in real terms versus when we're thinking about it in software.
That's smart, yeah, because then you could be like, well, we can actually do all these things simultaneously. They don't like even we were thinking we had to do them in this order, but like building a house, you can put in the electrical and the plumbing same time because once the walls are up, you can kind of do both of those. So probably
And
taking that and translating that to like software, then you find efficiencies.
what's the equivalent of the load-bearing wall that you cannot compromise on in your software? Do that first, right? So
Right, yeah.
it's just a very good way to start thinking about what's important and what's not, because at the end of the day, you have to make those choices.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I feel like we've covered everything. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
No, this was a lot of fun. The one thing I would say is financial services is a very interesting space. Before we started recording, we were talking a little bit about your experiences, kind of using your card and accepting payments on your website and all that stuff. And I can tell how kind of passionate you felt about it. And that's not unique for you. Every one of our customers, every one of our partners feel very passionately about their money, how it's spent, who's taking care of it, who's entrusted with it. So it's a very, for people listening, for engineers who are thinking about getting into software engineering, this is my plug to say that this is a very interesting space to apply some of that engineering practice and try to make it better, because there's a lot of problems we're solving in this space, and we're tackling one of them.
Very cool. Okay, so last two questions. What is your number one tip? So you have a lot of experience in doing startups and software engineering. Just anything that comes to mind.
The one thing I always talk about, especially with younger engineers, is around this idea of acting like an owner. A lot of people throw that around. It's a cliche, but it's very interesting to think about how much better your work is and how much better you enjoy it when you feel they have agency around what you're doing. So my biggest tip to anyone is try to think about what you're doing. What would you do in your job if you actually own that business? And in some cases you do, and it's clear and it's obvious what you need to do, or at least like you'll go figure it out. But a lot of people are working in big teams and big organizations, and it's very easy for them to say, well, I mean, it's not my problem. I'm just doing a job. And I was just like, it's so much better if you say, like, you know what? I don't care what's going to happen. I'm working at Amazon. I'm going to think about what would Jeff Bezos do here and act accordingly. And it, in a way, it just makes everything easier. Like if you approach like your job as a game, and you're trying to figure out how can I crack that game, I found that is a much better, much more fulfilling way to go about things than if you're saying, well, I mean, I'm trying to do X and they're asking me to do X and I'm just trying to do X and check out. So I don't know. I mean, it's not a unique or a new kind of perspective. But especially as an engineer, I try to think about it in terms of this systems kind of engineering problem, right? There's a box. My job is a black box, and I'm trying to get an output out of it, and I have to figure out what the right inputs I need to get into it. And my goal every day is to try to figure out what are the combination of inputs that will work. And it makes it feel like a puzzle. It makes it much more satisfying.
That's great advice. And then lastly, what's the best way for people to get in contact with you?
Well, the company is imprint.co. My email is my first name at imprint.co. If someone is interested in learning more about Imprint, about financial services, about just career advice or getting into fintech, please let me know. I'm always happy to talk to people and just kind of hopefully sell them on joining us, but at least maybe sell them on starting another company like Imprint. That would be really cool.
All right, very nice. Well, thanks so much for your time. It was a great conversation, and we'll catch
Yeah.
everyone next time on the podcast.
Thanks, Paul. That was fun.